Some professions, as you know, train together so that people can work together. Like if you're training to be a dancer or you're training to be a firefighter. But intellectuals tend to emerge very individually, independently, and only sometimes do they come together as what we call an intelligentsia that provides camaraderie and, more importantly, competition. And this was a very largely Jewish group of writers and thinkers who became known collectively as the New York Intellectuals. And they really did help to shape American culture from the 1930s through the 1970s and some of them beyond. So having said something about them collectively last time, I think we now can begin to look at what some of them, very few of them, brought to the mix. So today we talk about Delmore Schwartz, who was, I think, the most tantalizing figure as a human being among them, the youngest among them to gain recognition, and the one who suffered the most tragic decline, as tragic as it got for American Jews in the 1960s. His rise and fall and his early death made him a very intriguing subject, so that he became fictionalized as von Humboldt Fleischer in Saul Bellow's 1975 novel, Humboldt's Gift. And he got star billing in William Barrett's wonderful 1982 memoir called The Truants, Adventures Among the Intellectuals. And he was also the first of the group to earn a biography in 1977 by James Atlas. It's been republished several times, called Delmore Schwartz, The Life of an American Poet. And Atlas called him one of the most self-conscious writers who ever lived. And so that portrait here is very appropriate because you see him kind of reflecting himself in the mirror. And this kind of brings out that element of him, of this tremendous awareness of himself and use of himself in his writings. So he was born in Brooklyn in 1913 and raised in relative prosperity in a family that was already English speaking. The unsettled quality of his life began in childhood with the separation of his parents when he was 7 and when his younger brother was 4. His father had made money in real estate, and Delmore was raised by his mother with expectations of great wealth. So for much of his early life, he thought that he was going to come into money. And that crashed when his father died just after the market crash of 1929. Whatever wealth the father may have had was no longer there. And so this really contributed not just to the self-consciousness, the self-awareness, but really to the actual circumstances of Delmore Schwartz's life. He attended high school in Manhattan, college for 1 year at the University of Wisconsin, but then dropped out, came back to New York, and graduated with a BA in philosophy from New York University. And you'll see this in this story, but if you read Delmore Schwartz's poetry and you read his other stories, you find that this is by no means the only story in which he draws on this subject. But you know, not every child of a broken marriage has genius. And Delmore is what in Eastern Europe would have been called an Illui, a boy with a brilliant mind. He had tremendous ambition, and he published his first poems when he was 19 years old, and they got immediate notice. He trained, actually, for his craft as a poet by studying other poets. He began corresponding with the most famous of them in America at the time, with Alan Tate, with Richard Palmer Blackmuir, with Mark Van Doren. They were all prominent American poets who were all, by the way, also literary critics. And he too became both those things. At the time he published this story in 1937, he was also publishing essays on Ernest Hemingway, on the poets Ivor Winters and Wallace Stevens. And it was actually Wallace Stevens who recommended Delmore Schwartz to the Partisan Review, where they appointed him poetry editor. So for a time, and a long time, His talent camouflaged some of his unstable personality and his erratic behavior. But then, as time went on, his manic depressive condition worsened, and in his late 30s and 40s, he grew less and less able to control his moods. The paranoid episodes of his final years, I would say at least the final 15 years, isolated him from even the most loving and loyal of his friends, all of whom he began to accuse of being against him, of even wanting physically to harm him, and so on. So the life has its own kind of interest, but he interests us here, I think, as a talented author who wrote works of lasting importance, including this short story that we're going to be discussing, In Dreams Begin Responsibilities. Here and in almost all his poems and stories, he uses his life to represent the acculturated Jews of America of the second and third generation. So it's not just Delmore Schwartz in a vacuum, but it is Delmore Schwartz really as the product of this second and third generation of American Jews. Now, the immigrants from Eastern Europe called this country the Golden Land, Die Goldene Medina. And we're all familiar with the stories of children of immigrants who became millionaires, who became governors of states, or winners of the National Book Award. And as one of those great achievers, Delmore, however, warns, I think, against getting caught up in that golden glow because of the real-life troubles and real-life conditions that it conceals. So I think it's fair to say that he experiences freedom to achieve as also the freedom to fail. And this is an angle which is slightly different from many of the experiences of his contemporaries. So as children of immigrants, the New York intellectuals were distinctive for one other thing as well. They were the ones who brought the culture of Europe into America. Now, it's really intriguing to me that during the years that they were coming of age, years that came to be known as the interwar period between the two world wars, other American writers were heading out to Europe. T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, John Dos Passos, and of course, Gertrude Stein, who called them all the lost generation. By contrast, Delmore and his Jewish contemporaries were the conduits of European history and culture into America. So just as a taste of something, here are the first two stanzas of an early poem of Delmore's called The Ballad of the Children of the Tsar. It's a very moving poem. And if I may say, it was the favorite poem, I think, of the late Ezra Mendelsohn, very distinguished professor of Jewish history at the Hebrew University. So, and he was a historian of Russian and East European Jewry. So this is the poem. The children of the Tsar played with a bouncing ball in the May morning in the Tsar's garden, tossing it back and forth. It fell among the flower beds or fled to the north gate. A daylight moon hung up in the western sky, bald white. Like Papa's face, said Sister, hurling the white ball forth. While I ate a baked potato 6,000 miles apart in Brooklyn, in 1916, age 2, irrational, when Franklin D. Roosevelt was an arrow collar ad. Oh, Nicholas, alas, alas, my grandfather coughed in your army, hid in a wine-stinking barrel for 3 days in Bucharest, then left for America to become a king himself. So this is, it grabs you, right? So part of this is the familiar trope of the grandfather who escaped from the Tsar's army and made his way to America. But the poem is ultimately about both sets of children, those whom the Bolsheviks were going to massacre with the rest of the Tsar's family, as they did on July 16, 1918, and the child growing up in Brooklyn, who is not gloating over his family's escape, but rather terrified about how fate pursues all children alike. Along with the Tsar, who conscripted Jews into the army against their will, Delmore sees the Tsar's children, who did not stand a chance, and he draws a very affecting connection between them and himself. So in this strange way, he transforms the notion of the Bolshevik Revolution from a great liberating event into a murderous omen, and he invites us to see beneath the surface of political history what he has in common with those children of the Tsar. The familiar appears in a strange new light. So this is, one could say, obviously a great deal about his poetry, because he thought of himself primarily as a poet. And in that capacity, he was extremely sensitive about his name. This is a person who paid a great deal of attention to what defines you before you begin to define yourself. So unlike the way we refer to other writers by their last name, Pound and Eliot, Bellow, Malamud, Roth, he was Delmore, never Schwartz. This is something that his biographer points out. He created a character for a couple of his stories who was named Shenandoah Fish, drawing attention to the drop from the romantic high of Shenandoah to the low of fish that replicates the fall from the fancy Delmore, which comes apparently from De La Mer, to Lower East Side Schwartz, which is appropriate for a delicatessen. So this kind of mismatch was very good for a laugh, but less so if the person in question has serious ambitions to become the next great American poet. So why didn't he change his name? In introducing the New York intellectuals, I said that none of them ever considered converting from Judaism, but quite a number did change their names. Irving Howe changed his from Horowitz. Ivan Greenbaum became Philip Rav. And others had their names changed for them. William Phillips's father changed the family name from Litvinsky. And Sidney Hook's mother had anglicized his name from Saul, because she wanted to anglicize him, right? And then Thomas Stearns Eliot is known to us as T.S. Eliot. Edward Estlin Cummings was only known as E.E. Cummings. So all this is to say that poets changed their names in certain ways, and not just the poets. To further his Hollywood career, Bernard Schwartz became the actor Tony Curtis. But Delmore Schwartz decided to stay with the name that drew attention to its incongruity. Being a Jew in English America was to him a given, essentially inharmonious, and one might as well accept it. So you don't have to like who you are, but neither the children of the Tsar nor the American Jewish poet can change the condition that's imposed on him by birth. Now, the name did certainly not thwart his career. Remember that the Partisan Review, which I spoke of last time, started up again in 1937 as an independent magazine, that is, independent of its earlier communist affiliation. And in December 1937, in its very first issue, it published In Dreams Begin Responsibilities as the lead piece in this first issue. Delmore was then 24 years old. William Barrett, who was for a time his closest friend, recalls how much excitement the story generated. And Irving Howe says that those of us who read it at the time experienced a shock of recognition. We were stunned. Many people I know have remembered the story long after forgetting everything else in the first issue. So if we turn to the story, two kinds of questions one could ask. What was it that made it so special to them? And what is it that remains, I think, that makes it a classic to us as well? So this is how it begins. I think it is the year 1909. I feel as if I were in a motion picture theater, the long arm of light crossing the darkness and spinning, my eyes fixed on the screen. This is a silent picture, as if an old biograph one, in which the actors are dressed in ridiculously old-fashioned clothes, and one flash succeeds another with sudden jumps. The actors, too, seem to jump about and walk too fast. The shots themselves are full of dots and rays, as if it were raining when the picture was photographed. The light is bad. So we're plunged into a situation that's both familiar and strange. The narrator feels as if he's in a movie theater watching one of those jumpy early films. The movies are still at an early stage of development, apparently like the author in his career. So, but once the film begins to roll, all that jumpiness sort of calms down for a minute, and the film follows the actions of a young man on a very important date. The man picks up a young woman at her family home and takes her to the amusement park at Coney Island. And there they do what people commonly do. They walk along the boardwalk, they ride on the merry-go-round, they go for dinner at a restaurant where the man proposes marriage, and the woman accepts. And after that, they have their picture taken by a photographer, and then the young woman wants to have her fortune told. However, instead of the romantic follow-up that we might have hoped for, the tension between this couple keeps growing as they sit for the photographer. And then the man refuses to have his fortune told, and he marches off, and the fortune teller holds the woman back from going after him. Now, our emotional attachment in this story, and I think that we do get involved in it, is not to the couple, but to the narrator who is reacting to these events on the screen. He's watching, but he's also telling us in the present tense how his father, this man is my father, is going to meet my mother before they became his father and mother. He is the child who's going to result from the events of that day, desperately eager for the people that he identifies as father and mother to pay closer attention to what is at stake in their courtship. The projected film is the young man's retrospective projection, right, of how he came into being. But where is psychoanalysis that gives us that term and that concept of projecting? Psychoanalysis intends to be the understanding that helps to cure neurosis. This dream projects parentage as the inexorable fact that predetermines what, no matter how much, what understanding, no matter how much of it, can ever change, right? So he's projecting in that Freudian sense, but the projection in this case is not a tool that helps to cure him. It's rather something that helps to define him in ways that he is desperately unable to control. So going back over one's past was conceived as the talking cure, whereas this young man experiences his past as a sentence. And the image of the unrolling film tells us that he cannot change the script. So already at the beginning of this day in June, there is trouble brewing. When his mother comes down the stairs, all dressed up, my grandfather watches the interaction between the couple, and he doesn't like what he sees. He is worried. He is afraid that my father will not make a good husband for his older daughter. At this point, something happens to the film. Just as my father is saying something funny to my mother, I'm awakened to myself and my unhappiness. Just as my interest was rising, the audience begins to clap impatiently. And then the trouble in the film is taken care of. The film picks up again until the next point, where the viewer's anxiety interrupts the action. So this story unwinds on these three levels. The film is being shown in the theater. The audience is there to be entertained. And this man, this narrator, is growing ever more anxious. At a certain point, the power of the prose, I think, tells us that this man who's speaking to us must be a writer. And for example, as the mother and father, now already at Coney Island, lean on the rail of the boardwalk, the narrator sees that the waves in the ocean that they're looking at are growing rough. I'm just reading here. The waves come in slowly, tugging strength from far back. The moment before they somersault, the moment when they arch their backs so beautifully, showing green and white veins amid the black, that moment is intolerable. They finally crack, dashing fiercely upon the sand, actually driving full force downward against the sand, bounding upward and forward, and at last petering out into a small stream which races up the beach and then is recalled. My parents gaze absent-mindedly at the ocean, scarcely interested in its harshness. The sun overhead does not disturb them, but I stare at the terrible sun which breaks up sight and the fatal, merciless, passionate ocean. I forget my parents, I stare fascinated, and finally, shocked by the indifference of my father and mother, I burst out weeping once more. Now the old woman sitting next to him in the theater tries to calm him, but he's too near, he has to go to the men's room, stumbling over the feet of the other people seated in my row. He can neither influence his parents retroactively, nor can he find any companionship in the audience around him. The film continues. The father does not want to know the future, whereas the son telling the story is its outcome. America is built on endless opportunity. Greek tragedy is built on tragic probability. So by turning future into the inexorable past, this boy in the movie theater experiences the American dream as a Greek tragedy. So the parents, the child, and the old woman sitting in the audience coexist without connecting. So this is, I think, a second source of anxiety in the story. One of those sources is the sun. But being a personal story, why is it being shown in a theater? The writer is telling something very private, but he's telling it for publication in a national magazine. He is revealing himself to a general public. He registers his discomfort in turning his life into fiction for an impersonal and indifferent audience. In other words, the narrator can neither interact vertically with the past to change the defining condition of his life, nor can he interact horizontally to influence the effect of his art. He is uneasy about turning his personal life into fiction, about having his life displayed. But you cannot have it both ways. Had the parents not mated, he would not be there. And had he not created this work, we would not be reading him. On the vertical scale, free will doesn't work retroactively to undo the predetermined parts of existence, and horizontally, creation stops at the point that the artist releases his work to the audience. That's just the way it is. I think the mood is a little like that of Ecclesiastes. Only that shall happen which has happened. Only that occur which has occurred. There is nothing new under the sun. But instead of the composure of Ecclesiastes, here there is acute distress about that condition. So this intensely personal story, which corresponds to what we know of Delmore's parentage, is also, I think, a meditation on America. Its pessimism corresponds to the Marxist analysis of the Depression of the 1930s. But the culprit here is certainly not failed capitalism. It's rather the American dream of the father, who is described as having always felt that actualities somehow fall short. On the day that this father goes a-courting, he isn't ready for marriage yet, and yet he thinks of, quote, the big men he admires who are married, William Randolph Hearst and William Howard Taft, who has just become the President of the United States. So captivated by this possibility, he ignores probability. He doesn't take realistic measure of himself. And the mother, too, is caught up in her hopes to see the situation, and too caught up in them to see it for what it is. The romance is being conducted without self-awareness. They are caught up in the mythology of themselves, as though playing a part instead of thoughtfully living it. Had the parents been paying closer attention to one another, they might have anticipated and addressed some of the problems between them. But instead, they succumb to the superficialities. And of course, of this, Coney Island is the emblem. They are not mature enough. And here's the word, they are not responsible enough for what they undertake. So daytime fantasies of the kind encouraged by these distractions at Coney Island do not beget responsibilities. This, I think this view of America brings to mind F. Scott Fitzgerald's Jay Gatsby, whose dream blindsided him to the selfish depths of society. And you can also see here the influence of James Joyce's Ulysses, which was the most famous novel of the time, about a symbolic father and son. And Stephen Dedalus, the son, remarks very famously then, "History is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake." And Delmore turns this, I think, in this story into private history is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. Right? And yet, this American story is not quite an American tragedy. And here's a very interesting thing if you read this story right through to the end. When the son can no longer bear the tension of parents who are so careless that they might not have conceived him at all, he shouts in fear, "What are they doing? Don't they know what they are doing?" Shocking the audience around him and bringing the usher with his searchlight down the aisle to drag him away. As the usher drags him away, the usher says, "What are you doing? Don't you know that you can't do whatever you want to do? Why should a young man like you, with your whole life before you, get hysterical like this? Why don't you think of what you're doing? You can't act like this, even if other people aren't around. You will be sorry if you do not do what you should do. You can't carry on like this. It is not right. You will find that out soon enough. Everything you do matters too much." And he said that, dragging me through the lobby of the theater into the cold light, and I woke up into that bleak winter morning on my 21st birthday, the windowsill shining with its lip of snow, and the morning already begun. So just as so much here was the past being, the present being turned into the past, here at the very end we find out, which we might have suspected, but we find out dramatically that this was a dream, and from which he is awakened forcibly, and he wakes up on his 21st birthday. So it's a kind of initiation story, a story of his coming into majority, right? With that wonderful image of the winter, the windowsill shining with its lip of snow. And so the child was born after all, and he is risen up out of his nightmare on this crisp winter morning. And that lip of snow maybe suggests to us that a new story is about to begin. And what's more, what about the title? The title promises that this dream will beget responsibilities. In dreams begin responsibilities. So if that is the case, then if this was the dream, then in dreams begin responsibilities. It really suggests that what we have been reading in some form is what the parents did not feel. The parents were too careless, the parents do not pay enough attention, but in dreams begin responsibilities. It suggests that to some extent, however difficult this is the burden that it will become, that he will carry it. So there's more to be said about the story, of course, but for now, I think we should say, let's see what we have here. So firstly, the byplay between the film and the reaction to it dramatizes for us the question of determinism and freedom. The inexorable film stresses how much has been determined for us, and the narrator's cries in the dark, they are just that, cries in the dark. They have expressive force, but no power to change the course of events. Nor can the artist bearing his soul satisfy an audience that just wants to be entertained, that doesn't share or approve of his angst. You see how lonely it is on that front. He's not living, you know, he's not sitting in a theater where everyone is laughing along with him and sharing what he's feeling. He's in a theater where he's the only one who sees what is at stake. And the audience is there because for them, art is just something that they just want to see. Now, if I should add at this point a sentence about American Jews in the 1930s who did not pay attention to the pounding waves of the ocean or the merciless sun overhead, I think Delmore's idiosyncratically personal story may also explain why Jabotinsky and others could not hope to arouse American Jews to action and why no one else paid much attention to their plight. So the story never goes there. The story is just admired for its personal intensity, but I think it can be read as a historical testament. Then, in literary terms, the self-conscious, self-exploratory voice of Delmore's poems and stories paved the way for younger writers, Isaac Rosenfeld and Saul Bellow, and after them from Philip Roth. Willie Loman, we can just feel him waiting in the wings as the father of Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. And we can also feel Alexander Portnoy waiting in the wings as the son of an ineffectual father. The kind of monologue that comedians like Lenny Bruce and Woody Allen then developed for humor, Delmore developed into an American Jewish highbrow fiction. I would call this the voice of the eternal Jewish son who never becomes a Jewish father. The writers didn't necessarily stay in that condition, but the prototype of the Jewish son stayed firm. I think one might say almost to our very day. And then the story's sense of doom played itself out in real life. After an impressive career as poet, writer, critic, Delmore spun out of control in a way that Saul Bellow describes more memorably than any biographer can ever capture in his novel Humboldt's Gift, which is an elegy for Delmore. And as I say, who is called by the improbable name von Humboldt Fleischer that so resembles the improbability of Delmore Schwartz. The book, Saul Bellow's novel, conveys what a powerful effect Delmore Schwartz had on those around him. And the narrator who speaks for Saul Bellow breaks off to say, this is the voice of the narrator, the Belovian narrator in Humboldt's Gift, "I cannot accept the view of death taken by most of us and taken by me during most of my life on aesthetic grounds. Therefore, I am obliged to deny that so extraordinary a thing as the human soul can be wiped out forever. No, the dead are about us, shut out by our metaphysical denial of them, as we lie nightly in our hemispheres, asleep by the billions, our dead approach us. Our ideas should be their nourishment. We are their grain fields, but we are barren and we starve them. Don't kid yourself, though. We are watched by the dead, watched on this earth, which is our school of freedom. Now, it was the death of Delmore Schwartz that prompted Bellow to write this way. And then he continued to do so in another novel. Delmore simply remained for him too vivid to be consigned to oblivion. And then one other thing, his revision, if not his reversal of the American dream, for Jews especially, was an important stage in American Jewish thought. As part of this conservatism, he introduced the concept and term of responsibilities, emphasizing the responsibility over the dream, over and above the dream. There are people who might want to use Delmore Schwartz as a cautionary tale about Jews in America. In other words, look at this person, how high he was and how miserably he fell. I don't think that's quite fair. I mean, it has to do with mental illness and much else. His was a life of creative work, of creative travail. It's he who wrote the cautionary tale about dreams that beget responsibilities. And I think, I hope you agree, that there's good reason for us to continue reading it. Okay, thank you. For Robert Warshaw, it wasn't a matter of class or snobbery or level of intelligence. He was worried about the effect that mass culture could have on coarsening a democracy.